Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday the 5th of June, these are our main stories. The first memorial service for George Floyd has been held in Minneapolis, the US city where the African-American was killed in police custody. A virtual summit in London has raised billions of dollars for vaccinations and has secured the promise of hundreds of millions of doses of any future coronavirus inoculation for developing countries. Also in this podcast, evidence of a second coronavirus spike in Iran and...
A month ago, Juracina Vegunci worked as an Uber driver in Manaus. But now, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, he collects bodies from homes and hospitals.
The grim job opportunities in Brazil, courtesy of coronavirus. A first memorial service has taken place for George Floyd, the African-American man killed at the hands of Minneapolis police last week. As hundreds chanted outside, a small number of family, friends and officials paid their own tributes inside. During the ceremony, the singer Tawana Porter sang the hymn Amazing Grace.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
George's brother, Fel Onus, vowed that justice would be served.
All these people came to see my brother, and that's amazing to me that he touched so many people's hearts, you know, because he's been touching our hearts, you know. You come to Third Ward, where we're from, people are crying right now. That's how much they love them. You know, I'm just staying strong as I can because I need to get it out. I need to get it out. Everybody want justice. We want justice for George. He's going to get it. He's going to get it.
In his eulogy, the civil rights leader, Reverend Al Sharpton, took up that theme, saying the system of justice in the US had to change. He put the story of George Floyd into the perspective of history and called on people to stand up to white America.
George Floyd's story has been the story of black folks. Because ever since 401 years ago, the reason we could never be who we wanted and dreamed to be in is you kept your knee on our neck. What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
Reverend Sharpton then called for a moment of silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, to be exact. The same amount of time George Floyd was on the ground with an officer's knee on his neck. Many members of the audience closed their eyes, reached out to comfort each other and bent their heads in prayer. Our correspondent Jane O'Brien was there. I asked her how she had found the service.
Extremely moving, and just the one of many memorials that have been taking place. That was the formal one. There have been impromptu ones. Obviously the biggest right here where I'm standing, the very spot where George Floyd died. We had the members of the family visit here just after that formal service ended. You spoke about that very moving 8 minutes and 46 seconds silence. Well, that was repeated here too. People were quiet, they bowed their heads and they paid tribute to George Floyd. Now the mood has changed. It's become very much a place of community gathering. There are people talking, there are people sitting quietly, there are people bringing flowers, there are people just gathering to be together, because at this point, Minneapolis, having said farewell to George Floyd, he now goes on to North Carolina, and now starting the process of healing. And to do that, they say they need to be united and they need to continue coming together to the place where he died.
Yeah, I'm seeing the pictures on the feeds that are coming into the building. Huge crowds. This feels like a defining moment.
It feels like a defining moment, but there have been so many defining moments in America history. And George Floyd, of course, is the latest in a long line of African-American men who have died at the hands of police in America. What makes this different? That's the question that I've been asking people here. They say it's the fact that this has gone far beyond Minneapolis, that George Floyd has become a symbol of something much greater, a realization and a reckoning that America has suddenly come upon, that things really do need to change. And they point out the number of white people who have joined this protest. This isn't a black movement, it is an American movement. And they also say that they're taking a great deal of comfort from the fact that there are so many protests around the globe. It is an international moment. And to coin the phrase of one person I spoke to here, the eyes of the world is on America now, and America can no longer escape that glare.
Yeah, the word change keeps coming up. Reverend Al Sharpton called for fundamental change at the federal level. What kind of change is he referring to, and how likely is it to happen?
Two very difficult questions. The first is that he wants a return to some of the laws that were put in place under the Obama administration and that President Trump has walked back from recently, commissions that recognise problems when they arise in cities and enable cities to confront them. The other question is, will it actually happen at a federal level? To be perfectly honest, America is so divided, and even though so many people support police reform, this is still a political hot potato. We've seen the response from the White House. It's a bit like gun control legislation. There's a mass shooting. Everybody says things have got to change. Congress says that they will act. They don't. And what we see more often than not is grassroots in action. People from within the community take matters into their own hands. A lot of that we've been seeing recently. But they're the ones that are most likely, I think, to force any change by holding their own local police forces accountable and holding their representatives at a local level accountable. This seems to be the pattern in America over the last few years, is that things happen at a local level. It doesn't necessarily follow through that it's going to happen at a federal level.
Jane O'Brien. The national outrage that followed George Floyd's death has prompted a number of states to consider new legislation aimed at overhauling police procedures and systemic inequalities. Nikki Jones researches the relationship between ethnic minorities and the US police. She's Professor of African American Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. She told the BBC's Paul Henley about some of the root causes, as she sees it, of the ongoing unrest.
Some people can think of this as a problem of policing, but it's much more than a problem of policing. It's really a problem of the condition of Black people in the United States and the persistent vulnerability to violence, to state violence and to structural violence, and what people feel is a lack of accountability when it comes to the killings of Black people. When I talk about the vulnerability to violence and the persistent vulnerability to state violence and structural violence, part of what I mean is having police in your neighborhood and have them seemingly everywhere and still not feeling as if they're there to protect you. And then, in fact, when you interact with them, they treat you as the problem, they treat you as the target. And for example, this is not where I'd conducted my research, but I think the most well-known example may be the Stop and Frisk program in New York City, where you have over 800,000 predominantly Black people who are, and people of color who are stopped in a seemingly arbitrary way each day. And so the police are there, they're in their neighborhoods, but they are treating them as if they are the enemy.
Has there been a heightened awareness of the problem among police? Has the behavior of officers towards young Black men improved at all in recent years?
I don't know if we can say that the behaviors have improved at all. I think that we have seen reform in policing at the local level that we hadn't seen previously, and a commitment to that. We've also seen an administration that has pushed back on that reform, that hasn't necessarily taken up the recommendations that were left by the Obama administration's look into policing following Ferguson, and has made it very difficult to hold police departments accountable. And when it comes to the condition of the relationship between Black people and the police, that's not something that's going to change in 5 years. It's not something that's changed in 50 years.
I think more than one study has suggested that a clear majority of police officers think there is racial equality in the US. Can anything change before the penny falls, the penny drops, and they become clear that there isn't equality?
Well, we don't need those officers to believe that there is racial inequality in order for change to happen, in order for police departments to be held accountable, in order to constrain their ability to use force against the public. And what we're seeing now is a shift even from accountability to abolitionist alternatives in the U.S. We're seeing institutions sever their relationships with police departments. We're seeing school districts sever their relationships with police departments. We're seeing people imagine other ways to ensure community safety without the police department. So whether or not they get on board, the change is already underfoot. And certainly there's cultural tensions within police departments, but I think that change is going to come whether or not they're ready for it.
And do you share former President Obama's optimism at the moment that there is a great positive energy to be harnessed from the past 7 days?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've seen criminal justice reform at different levels in the U.S. since Ferguson. We've seen reforms in fines and fees. We've seen the progressive prosecutor movement. We've seen decarceration. We see racial equity coming to pretrial reform. I don't think all of that would have happened in the way that it's unfolded without the protests of the recent past. And I think in this moment, we're already seeing people respond in ways that will make change. And it's not a one-off victory ever. It will be a constant struggle. We will always have to be vigilant. But I do think that this energy has already led to actions that to some would have been unthinkable 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Professor Nikki Jones. Global cases of COVID-19 are accelerating quickly in India, Brazil and Mexico, with Iran facing a potential second wave. On Thursday, Tehran announced its highest figure of new infections since February. Our global health correspondent Naomi Grimley has been looking at the data.
Iran's graph of daily cases now resembles a double peak, having relaxed its restrictions in mid-April. Iran's health minister has revealed his worries about people crowding onto public transport. Wedding celebrations, he warned, could turn into funerals. The World Health Organization says it's concerned about the accelerating epidemics in the Americas. Both Brazil and Mexico have just recorded their largest daily numbers for deaths so far. In Brazil, the total number of infections is soon set to pass 600,000. In India, they fear the peak is still to come. Cases are spiralling in rural areas where weak healthcare and malnutrition are added complications. The official number of infections stands at 218,000. That's a fraction of the USA's official total. But a lack of testing capacity means the true number will be much bigger.
Well, as we heard in Naomi's report, Iran is facing a potential second wave of cases. This comes after it moved in phases to reopen as much of the country as possible. More from Kasra Naji of our Persian service.
It looks like they opened up too early. If you look at the curve of the people who have coronavirus, the new cases, the last 24 hours, we had 3,574 people in one day. That is almost the same number as when Iran went into lockdown about 2.5 months ago. And so we are back to where we were. And if you look at the curve, it started, this latest curve going up, it started about exactly a month ago, on the 3rd or 4th of May, when the Iranians opened up businesses and shops in Iran after a month and a half of lockdown. It goes back to then. And since then, they also started opening up shrines, they opened up mosques and ordered government employees to go back to work. So all this have added together hand in hand, and what we see now, it looks as if we have truly started going into the second phase of this coronavirus.
Presumably the credibility of the government is on the line here.
Well, yes, in a sense that you may accuse the government of President Rouhani of having sort of opened up too early. But on the other hand, don't forget, Iran is under punishing U.S. sanctions. Economics of the country are in terrible shape. And people cannot go without working, many people. So there is quite a bit of pressure on the government to open up and let people go and make money and earn a living.
Kasra Naji. Well, as we've heard, the World Health Organization has singled out Brazil as a particular concern. It has around 600,000 confirmed cases, but experts believe the true number could be far higher because of a lack of testing. Amazonas state is one of the worst affected areas. The BBC's Camila Mota sent this report from the city of Manaus, the largest in the region.
A month ago, Juracina Vegante worked as an Uber driver in Manaus. But now, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, he collects bodies from homes and hospitals.
On my first day, I felt shaken because there were so many bodies, just one after the other. I couldn't count.
The organization he works for, SOS Funeral, provides body collection services for those who can't afford them. In April, they collected 793 bodies, almost four times more than the monthly average. He's wearing a gown, rubber gloves. A mask covers his mouth and nose, protected behind a face shield. This morning, Juraci and his colleague drive to a social housing complex in the neighborhood of Tarumã to collect another body.
Olá, boa tarde.
Juraci is in the home of 8-year-old Manuel Martins da Silva, who died that morning in his sleep from COVID-19. After spending a few days in hospital, he was discharged, but then his condition deteriorated at home. His body is taken from the bedroom and placed in a coffin to be taken to the local cemetery. His family look on solemnly. Juraci says a lot of people in Manaus are dying at home, struggling to deal with the loss of their loved ones.
It's a moment of shock for them when they see us with all their apparel, all their uniform, all their PPE. They are already saying goodbye to their loved ones.
Manuel has a big family, but because of social distancing rules, only his son and daughter went to his burial, which took place on the same day. A mechanical digger is busy at work in the cemetery. The big machine contrasts with a field of really simple graves, each one of them marked only by a wooden frame with a hand-painted cross on one end. All around are fresh mounds of earth, ready for new burials. Parked outside, there's a refrigerator container with the capacity to store up to 40 bodies for those who can't be buried on the same day. As the city struggles to cope, authorities have turned a school into a field hospital with over 160 ICU beds. Ricardo Nicolau is the hospital director.
We are now working with 163 beds. I could reach 279 beds. That's the estimate of our maximum capacity, using every single space available. Every other day, new beds become available and they are automatically taken by a new patient.
Nationwide, thousands continue to be infected each day and deaths show no sign of slowing. Brazil remains far behind other countries in containing this pandemic.
Camila Mota. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, imbibing the atmosphere where Anne Frank wrote her famous diary, all on your own.
How many people could you fit in Anne's room at 1.5 metre distance?
We think it's only one, actually. But anyways, it's also an opportunity. When would you be able to be alone in Anne's room?
The advantages of social distancing. German police are waiting to see if the appeal they launched earlier this week for new information about the disappearance of three-year-old Madeleine McCann will deliver results. The British girl disappeared in 2007 while on holiday in the Portuguese resort of Praia da Luz. And now, after 13 years, the Germans believe they have a breakthrough, triggering this reaction across the world.
Die dreijährige Madeleine McCann schläft mit ihren Geschwistern in einem Ferienapartment im portugiesischen Praia da Luz in der Nähe.
From the moment Maddie McCann vanished from a holiday villa in Portugal 13 years ago, the world has been transfixed.
Police... O Departamento Federal da Polícia Criminal da Alemanha admite que Madeleine McCann foi morta.
It was a case that made global headlines, the mystery disappearance of three-year-old Madeleine McCann.
Du nouveau dans l'affaire Maddie, cette petite Britannique de 3 ans disparue au Portugal en 2007.
If you have any information which could help the police with their investigation, you can contact Operation Grange, the incident room number.
Well, now German prosecutors say a German national referred to as Christian B, who's in prison for other offences, is being investigated for the murder. And they've asked the thousands of people who were in the Portuguese resort at the time to look again at their holiday photos. Our correspondent Gavin Lee is outside Praia da Luz in the Algarve.
We've come at the moment, I'm talking to you, you probably hear sort of the bamboo rustling in the wind. It's a pretty isolated property, painted yellow and white, in fields high up in the hills behind Praia da Luz. This is one of two properties where German police say that he was using, local media reporting that it was used to stash stolen goods. His life here was basically existing through a life of crime, burglary, drug dealing. It's not clear whether Portuguese authorities knew of his background, his convictions for child sex offences in Germany, though. So we're still trying to work out a picture there. But we are only about a mile from where British police, back in 2014, were searching this site in the fields close by for the body of Madeleine McCann.
And there is some mobile phone evidence that could be crucial.
Well, this is the fact that an hour before Madeleine McCann went missing, in May 2007, it's around 9 o'clock in the evening, a call was made between 7:30 and about 2 minutes past eight between the suspect, Christian B, and another man on a Portuguese mobile number. The police are saying this is a person of interest. You've got probably three significant leads. The two properties, one of which I'm talking to you from, you have the two vehicles, the identity, but not yet a photo fit of the suspect who is in this prison in Germany, and the fact that the mobile phone message puts in the area. What they lack, though, is clear evidence. And don't forget, this coordinated working between Germany, Portugal and British police has been going on now from at least 2017 on a quiet working way. They've got to a point, it seems, where now they need the public's help. But if there's something that they can start to get maybe a tracking of where the suspect was, who he might have been in contact with, perhaps that's where clear evidence emerges.
This new suspect, why wasn't he being investigated back at the time?
This is such a good question. So we understand that the Metropolitan Police in London had a list from Portugal of 600 people of interest who were in and around the Praia da Luz area. Not all of them suspects, some of them just points to pick up and reference, and included this man, this Christian B. We don't know why he wasn't investigated further. Did they know about his child sex offences? He also is said to have committed a rape of a woman in her 70s in 2005. There was an extradition request from Germany. He was actually being extradited for to be connected with other child sex offences. But in this case, it appeared that the trial was going ahead for rape. Portuguese police at the moment are giving very little information, I think partly, Alex, because of the criticism, the heavy criticism over the years that they've faced for allegations that they've misplaced big parts of information of this case, trampled over evidence, etc. Maybe that's why they are so quiet and letting the Germans take the lead this time.
Gavin Lee. A virtual summit in London has raised billions of dollars for vaccinations, and the drug company AstraZeneca says it would now be able to supply 2 billion doses of its potential coronavirus vaccine. The firm has teamed up with a number of organisations, including two backed by Bill Gates, to produce a COVID-19 vaccine being developed by a team in Oxford. The announcement was made at a global vaccination conference being hosted in the UK. Our global health correspondent Tulip Mazumdar reports.
Leaders from around the world committed to doing all they can to find and then quickly distribute what many of them refer to as a people's vaccine against COVID-19. These unprecedented times call for an unprecedented approach to developing and scaling up new vaccines, according to the Vaccine Alliance, Gavi. It launched a new financing mechanism aimed at ensuring poorer countries also get swift access to any eventual vaccines. AstraZeneca is the first manufacturer to sign up to the new scheme with the vaccine it's developing with the University of Oxford. That product is currently still in human trials. The company says it will have wider data on its efficacy by August. But plans are getting underway now to find new manufacturing plants and investing in the raw materials and technologies needed to mass produce the vaccine in a number of different countries. This approach is a massive gamble, as the Oxford vaccine or any of the other most advanced vaccine candidates may not actually work. But Gavi, together with many world leaders speaking at the summit, said this was a risk the world must take to ensure as many lives could be saved in rich and poor countries as fast as possible once a vaccine is found.
Tulip Mazumdar. Vineyards across France hit hard by the pandemic are venturing into new territory. Vast quantities of unsold wine are being turned into hand sanitizer and other industrial products, as Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
The French wine business was already going through a rough phase hit by falling domestic consumption and new taxes from the United States. The COVID lockdown came as an added blow. Restaurants were shut, exports froze, and contrary to what some expected, the French did not take to drinking more in confinement, but actually drank less. To help get wine growers through their difficulties, the French government has now, with EU approval, permitted the distillation of some 200 million litres of wine currently lying in stock. Growers will get a small compensation amounting to at most 60 euro cents a bottle. Not much compared to what they might have expected to sell their wine for, but at least something to tide them through. The wine will be distilled to make ethanol, in other words, pure alcohol, and some of that will go to make hand sanitizer to help in the COVID crisis.
Hugh Schofield. This week, museums and art galleries in the Netherlands opened their doors to the public for the first time since the pandemic forced them into lockdown. Our reporter Anna Holligan has been to two of Amsterdam's top cultural venues, which usually attract more than a million visitors a year, the Rijksmuseum and the Anne Frank House, to see how they're managing the challenge of operating in a socially distanced world.
When you're in the museum, you can roam around free.
Taco Dibbets, director of the Rijksmuseum.
In the end, art is about freedom.
In every room, there are these kind of stickers, I guess, on the floor, which say 1.5 metres.
Yeah. There's reminders that you should keep a distance. It's such a habit of human beings to crowd.
Why is the Night Watch so world famous? After all, it's basically just a portrait of a group of civic guardsmen in 17th century Amsterdam.
How do you make sure that everyone who comes through here gets as much time with the Night Watch as they would like? Or will you have to say, OK, you've had 5 minutes, 10 minutes now, time to check out the Vermeer?
We have limited the amount of people with the entrance. But once you're in the museum, you can stay as long as you want. We made some alterations in the hanging of the paintings. For example, this room where you have the Vermeers. In order not to have crowding in front of them, we gave them more space so you can stand in front of a painting in a safe way.
We're all super sensitive now to our proximity to others, as we have to be. And in a way, that could distract you from being as immersed as you usually are when you look at a piece of art like this, if you're having to think, is that person a bit too close?
But you do want to look at the art together, and especially with Vermeer, whose paintings are so incredibly detailed and finely painted, you want to point out and say, oh, do you see the bread crumbling on the table, or do you see how the milk spires out into a bowl?
It's a form of escapism. You can almost come in here and forget almost about the reality outside for a moment.
Corona is a crisis. It's a pandemic. It will have an end, but we want the institutions to continue for eternity.
I'll open the door for you, yes?
Okay, let's go in.
We're entering the Anne Frank House, made famous by a diary kept by the Jewish teenager who lived here in hiding during the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands.
So we will have people, of course, inside the house in order to monitor the situation. We have cameras.
Ronald Leopold is the executive director.
Okay, so we go up.
It's a real narrow staircase that people will be coming up at the same time as having to keep their distance.
Yes. This is the bookcase that covered the entrance to the hiding place. This was the bottleneck. People sometimes had to wait for 5 or 10 minutes before they could enter. And then this is where we are inside the hiding place. So this is Anne's room, her desk in where she wrote a diary.
How many people could you fit in Anne's room at 1.5 metre distance?
We think it's only one, actually, max two. But anyways, it's also an opportunity. It's also an opportunity for many people. I mean, when would you be able to be alone in Anne's room?
How important do you think it is to allow people to come back in here after we've been in a state of isolation that is incomparable?
I'm sure that people who are going to visit the Anne Frank House after being trapped at home because of the coronavirus will experience this visit in a different way than before. Anne was forced to go into hiding, into isolation, because of human beings, because of what we are capable of. It's very different.
Ronald Leopold ending that report from Anna Holligan. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.